Did you see that Obama and her husband are going to be campaigning with Harris pretty soon?
Oh, guys, you literally did an Obama cold open last week. You can't just do an Obama reference at the top of every episode. People are going to start to notice, like, besides me.
I did not see that. I did see that. I think Michelle's doing some of her own things out there, right? She's really odd on the hustings.
Well, this is the thing is that, I mean, this is one thing that I came across when I was doing the Harris profile is that she went all in on Harris. And this was a very, in some ways, very smart thing that Harris did when she was in the first years of the vice presidency was that she became very close with Michelle.
Okay, but at least Evan Osnos got in that exclusive reporting there. And that's why they pay him the big bucks. Kamala Harris, in her time as vice president, has become very close with Michelle Obama. Of course, Evan is on a first-name basis with her and just calls her Michelle. Hi, everyone. It's Russ again with this week's episode of the New Yorker Political Scene, with your regular dose of Obama intrigue news as brought to you by Evan Osnos and the hosts of the New Yorker Political Scene. We are excitingly close to the presidential election. It's just right around the corner. Can you feel it? I can feel it. And it feels, on the one hand, exciting because Donald Trump could win. That'd be exciting, right? Not necessarily in a good way, but it certainly would make us feel something. And even if he loses, he'll probably try to claim victory and there could be a bunch of chaos and carnage around that. And that'd be exciting. And then on the other hand, I'm feeling a bit of dread because no matter what happens, it seems like it's going to be bad. Bad for us here in the United States, but mostly bad for people in Gaza, in the West Bank, in Lebanon, maybe Iran. But you've all heard me whinging about the Middle East before. Don't worry, I'm not going to be doing too much of that this week, because instead I'll be whinging about billionaires and their outsized role in our politics, and frankly, our lives. It's another favorite topic of mine, folks. And as you're about to hear, the New Yorker Political Scene hosts have given me the opportunity to delve into it this week. But first, Evan Osnos has a request. It's interesting, but it does seem like something that should really be between him, his partner, and perhaps a proctologist.
I want to take a moment just to gape.
All right, Evan, that's enough of that.
Slack-jawed at some of these new numbers that are out on the scale of money that are coming into the Trump campaign. We already knew that the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, is funding a big Get Out the Vote operation, somewhat controversially, even within Trump circles. People wonder whether he knows what he's doing. Now we know just how much money he spent, $75 million in the most recent quarter. Meanwhile, Miriam Adelson, who's a longtime conservative donor, she spent $95 million in the same period.
Hachi-machi. That is a lot of money to be spending towards a political campaign. So the backbone of this episode is a new piece by our very own Susan Glasser about the super wealthy and all the money they're giving this year to support Donald Trump's reelection. In her piece, which we're going to get into a bit, Glasser outlines how the 2010 Supreme Court ruling on Citizens United paved the way for unlimited money to be spent on political campaigns, but how the Trump campaign is breaking some records in that regard. Here's how Glasser describes it.
We've become inured to just how out of control the amounts of money that individual wealthy people are dumping into our politics and distorting and warping our politics more than I even realized. By the way, more than even at the beginning of the Trump era. So you mentioned Miriam Adelson. She's a great example. They've been longtime big donors, her and her late husband, the casino magnate, Sheldon Adelson. Okay, well, they gave $50 million to Romney Super PAC, right? Kind of the last of the team normal Republicans, right? Still out of control money in politics. Boom, up to $90 million giving to support Trump's reelection in 2020. She's now over $100 million and counting in this election cycle. I just think that tells you a lot about the metastasization of money in politics and also how much influence are these billionaires going to be able to ask in exchange for this money to Trump?
Now, it's funny. In this episode, Glasser, of course, has to pay tribute to the book written by her colleague, our own Jane Mayer, about money in politics. But like Glasser's article here, Mayer's book, Dark Money, also points the finger almost entirely at the super wealthy pouring money into Republican campaigns, hardly noting that Democrats are basically doing the same exact thing. I've talked a little bit about Jane Mayer's book on here, but basically it outlines the role played by the Koch brothers in funding and thus shaping Republican politics, with very little mention of the neoliberal shift and the financialization of the Democratic Party and its affiliated campaigns, PACs, and super PACs.
Yeah, everybody knows, I'm sure, but if you don't, Jane's amazing book, Dark Money, is the gold standard definitive portrait of how America got off the rails in money and politics. And, you know, we're all just filling in the details from there.
Now, in her piece, Glasser gets into some funny scenes featuring Republican mega donors. One of the main characters in that piece is Nelson Peltz, who apparently is a conservative billionaire with a giant $300 million estate close to Mar-a-Lago. And despite the fact that he supported Tim Scott in the Republican primary, he ended up throwing a fundraiser for Donald Trump with a couple dozen other billionaires at his Florida home.
The host of this dinner gathering, he was so disgusted by January 6th that he went on CNBC the very next day and he said that Donald Trump was a disgrace. He apologized to America for voting for Donald Trump. He had had a $10 million fundraiser at this huge mansion of his called Montsorel in the 2020 campaign. He said he was sorry. Well, of course, America, we all know the ending of this, right? Which is that one by one, they somehow find ways to rationalize it. February 16th at this dinner was Nelson Peltz's moment to rationalize it. He wasn't even on speaking terms with Donald Trump, and he opens this dinner at his home for about two dozen of the wealthiest Republicans in the country. And according to an attendee I spoke with, he opens this dinner and he says, Donald Trump is a terrible human being. I know many of us really don't like him. And yet it was clear by this point Trump was going to win the nomination again. And he said, well, you know, the country's going to hell and we don't like Joe Biden, so we have no choice. We're going to have to fall in line.
Look, that's interesting and frankly good reporting there from Glasser. And I think this is a good opportunity for me to zoom out and say, I subscribe to The New Yorker. And in general, that magazine and the hosts of the political scene sometimes do excellent reporting. And it's one of the reasons I find myself hate listening to it in the first place. They have the time, the resources, and the connections to every once in a while do some great journalism. But when they're allowed to opine or analyze or contextualize the world of politics, that's usually where they're committing the worst atrocities. I don't have sources who attend fundraisers for Donald Trump at the $300 million home of some billionaire who actually hates Donald Trump. But also, I know better than to say with no caveats that one of the reasons why Kamala Harris is such a confident public figure is because she's a Brahmin. I wouldn't be out there saying, based on one interview I did back in January, that Donald Trump is of able body and mind to run for the presidency again in 2024. And in the case of this piece by Susan Glasser, I think she and the other hosts of the political scene are overemphasizing the difference between the influence that billionaires have on Republicans versus Democrats. A few weeks ago, I did an exchange of sorts with the great podcast Michael and Us. Since then, that show featured an interview the host Luke Savage did with Tim Schwab, who wrote a book called The Bill Gates Problem, in which Schwab outlines all of the ways that Gates has used his money and his foundation to influence politics and things like public health. Back during the COVID-19 pandemic, I was working at CNN when they hosted a global town hall with Bill Gates, who, by the way, is not an epidemiologist, a pharmacologist, or even a doctor for that matter, about what was being done to establish and distribute a vaccine for COVID. Now, Gates, whose entire empire relies on intellectual property, was then against the idea of waiving patent protections on the vaccines. Now, this became a personal obsession of mine, and I won't bore you with all of the details because I think for the most part, we as a society have sort of decided to act like COVID never happened. But to me, it was a very glaring example of how a liberal billionaire was able to use his influence in a way that had tremendous consequences for the entire planet. There were petitions and op-eds being written by epidemiologists in India and South Africa and other places in the global south that were essentially saying we should all be allowed to produce our own vaccines once the recipe has been established, which was clearly the way to save as many lives as possible. But Gates was against that idea because he said it would create a dangerous precedent by not allowing those who had developed the vaccines to benefit from those discoveries. Never mind the fact that those pharmaceutical companies took hundreds of millions of dollars from the US and Europe towards their rapid development, Bill Gates thinks that intellectual property is more important than saving millions of lives during a pandemic, and thus must be protected first and foremost. Anyway, I highly recommend checking out that interview with Tim Schwab on Michael and Us. And I think I'm going to be reading his book as well if we want to establish some sort of book club about it. But anyway, let's go back to how the Republican billionaires are fucking us. The next detail from Susan Glasser's reporting is actually pretty funny. Do you guys remember Gordon Sondland? He's that billionaire who had a hotel chain or whatever that essentially bought the ambassadorship to the European Union by giving $1 million to Trump's inaugural committee. This is from Susan Glasser's article. During the 2019 impeachment inquiry of Trump, Sondland acknowledged under oath that there had been a quid pro quo in Trump's attempt to pressure the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, into investigating Trump's political opponents. Trump fired Sondland 2 days after the impeachment trial ended in a Senate acquittal. Nonetheless, Sondland told me that he planned to vote for Trump again. It's a binary choice, he said, and I want the Trump policies.
Amazingly enough, someone told me this summer, oh, you can't even believe it. There's Gordon Sondland back out there supporting Donald Trump. And so I reached him. I called him at his house in the Hamptons, which seemed appropriate for this discussion. And, you know, we had this conversation and he said, I've been bundling for Republican candidates all the way back to George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney, Jeb Bush, and then Donald Trump. And the difference is the zeros that have been added to it, the sums, even compared with the beginning of Trump, are unbelievable. He said, you used to be able to buy a seat at a roundtable for $50,000. Now add a zero, you're talking $500,000 just to get a seat at the table for a 10 or 15 minute conversation with the candidate where, you know, nothing is really said. And he said, today's donor class really has different expectations. That's along with those increased dollar amounts.
Dog. You bought an ambassadorship in Europe for $1 million. Though in all fairness, if you're a billionaire with giant multinational businesses, there's plenty else you might want beyond an ambassadorship.
He now calls Musk his future secretary of cost cutting. This, again, is a man who would be the most self-interested person you could imagine, a walking conflict of interest. He has billions and billions of dollars in federal government contracts. I believe he's one of the largest Pentagon contractors at this point. Our space program through SpaceX is highly dependent upon him. Of course, his venture Tesla wouldn't really exist today if it hadn't been for significant government subsidies. Can you imagine a more conflicted person to be sitting as a czar over all government spending in a future Trump administration?
I so agree.
Now, there's a lot of political stories swirling around now in the final stretch of the campaign, but I am kind of surprised we're not hearing more about Musk. Not so much because of his million-dollar giveaways for voters who register in battleground states and take his little pledge, but also because the dude owns one of the most influential social media platforms in the world. The liberals got their panties all in a bunch when Russia apparently had a few Facebook groups that spread divisive stories around the internet. But isn't it crazy that the guy who is 100% in the tank for Trump is running this giant social media platform that he's using to promote Trump and all of his right-wing talking points? Like, what's going to happen if Trump loses and then denies the results of the election? Imagine what Twitter will be like then. Like I said, it's one of the reasons I'm excited about the election, if I'm being honest, to see what sort of carnage awaits us.
The natural rebuttal to what you just said, Jane, will be, well, people will say, oh, don't be naive. There's always been money in politics. And I think it's a huge mistake to succumb to that. That's an illusion of being wised up. Because what we're actually saying here is that things have fundamentally changed. The differences of degree are so vast that they become a difference in kind. And that this really begins to approximate the kind of oligarchic relationship that you see in other countries. It's not just a
natural extension.
In very
corrupt other countries.
They're not saying it, but basically they just mean Russia. They're using the word oligarch. They're talking about government corruption. They should just say Russia. You know they want to. But yeah, is America Russia? No. Even on their own podcast, these guys have acknowledged that Joe Biden dropped out of the race, not because of polling, not because Democratic insiders, or because of Biden's inner circle talking him out of it. It was the donors. Money. Nancy Pelosi basically told him there wouldn't be enough money for him to make it to November, and that's what tipped the scales and gave us Kamala Harris. It's why both leading candidates fully back Israel's genocide in Gaza, and it's why we can't have public health care, our political system is bought and paid for. These three have basically said as much. But A, here they're talking about individual donors doing it rather than industries or publicly traded businesses or whatever. And B, it's conservatives backing Trump, not liberals pushing any number of corporate interests on the American people. Would I rather live in Russia? No. But that doesn't mean that the United States isn't completely corrupt either.
I mean, 2016 was a bit of an aberration because actually Hillary Clinton raised more than Donald Trump and it didn't make her win. Generally, if you look back over the last few decades, almost always the candidate that spent the most is the candidate that wins. Not always, but almost always. And this year, I mean, we have to say, just in fairness, Kamala Harris is raising historic amounts of money herself. But as Susan points out in this piece, it's different, the money that she's raising. She has more of the wealthiest people in the country giving to her. But on the Democratic side, they're giving smaller donations to her. And she has many more really small donations.
Okay, so let's take a closer look now at what they're talking about here and the difference between the Harris and Trump campaigns. Democrats have retained an advantage in small online donations, while Republicans rely on higher percentage of large contributions. As of late September, 68% of contributions to the Trump political network had come from big donors, compared with 59% from Democrats. Trump, in other words, needs his billionaires more than the other side does. Raising more money from fewer donors is the party strategy. Now, when it comes to the parties themselves, and I guess in particular the Republican Party, they seem to be less in control of the candidates in their campaigns because of the increased influence of these mega donors. Here's how Glasser explains it.
You know, Tom Davis, who was, you know, really savvy inside player Republican congressman, he ran the party's Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, so he's very familiar with fundraising of a previous era. He pointed this out, that this Supreme Court decision and what's happened since then essentially cemented the demise of the political parties, and it distributed power because it distributed money out to the ideological margins of super PACs on both the left and the right. And so one of the structural reasons for the incredible divisiveness and perpetual outrage machines that we're seeing on both the right and the left is that that's where the money lies right now. It lies not in the center, but in the margins. It doesn't have the filter really of the parties anymore.
So she talks there as if this were a binary. But does anyone actually think that the money sloshing around in the Democratic Party or in Democratic campaigns is controlled by far left interests? What would that even mean? I don't think I know of a single left-wing billionaire. You might say, well, Michael Bloomberg is a billionaire who spends shitloads of money on campaigns, and I guess he did have some extreme political views, like how he banned giant sodas in New York City or whatever. But I really don't see how any of the super donors to the Democratic Party are a mirror image of the sort of hard right agenda we see when it comes to those peddling influence with Donald Trump and the Republicans. There is no mirror image to Elon Musk on the far left. What you actually have are centrists or even conservative Democrats spending money on campaigns or shaping the public's interest in some way. I'm thinking of people like Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Reid Hoffman, who's a venture capitalist and the chairman of LinkedIn and is super pro-Israel, George Soros. These people aren't on the left. They're liberals at best and libertarians or conservative Democrats, if we're really being honest. Now, is it concerning that the parties are losing power because these billionaires are giving money directly to the candidates? Is that better somehow than corporations or individuals giving money to the parties and then the parties shaping policy and political agendas that way? I don't know. Either way seems pretty bad, if you ask me.
You're absolutely right that it's one of the reasons that politics is so divided and so polarized and particularly so extreme. I also think it's one of the reasons, though, that democracy seems broken. And if you look at the priorities of the public, according to public opinion polls, they are not the same priorities as these gigantic donors. Vast numbers of people, to begin with, do not like the idea of billionaires controlling American politics on both the left and the right. They hate Citizens United and want to stop this. Okay, that's one difference. Another is that vast numbers of Americans favor more redistributive programs in terms of income. They want to see a better social safety net not a worse one. And I don't think that's what Elon Musk is thinking about. I hate to say it. And they want to see higher taxes on the super rich. Very, very few super rich people want to raise their own taxes.
Look, I agree with Jane Mayer here. And I think she feels safe talking about redistributive politics because it's couched in this discussion about the right. But really, it is a much broader problem with our politics and people's lack of faith in our political system. I agree with Jane Mayer 100% on that. But I'm not sure that saying, well, if Democrats only take 59% of their contributions from big donors, where Republicans are taking 68%, as Susan Glasser is reporting, that that's a major difference between the two parties.
That one of the stakes, one of the things that is on the line here in this election, is that there are a generation of younger voters especially who are baffled, perplexed, mystified, and ultimately on the verge of despair about exactly the kinds of things you just talked about, Jane. Let's be clear, there are big donors on Harris's side as well. But the huge fundraising advantage she has is because of this dramatic advantage of small donors and the number of people that have come out who have poured money in, particularly in those early weeks after she got into the race. And I think if she is able to win with that, it is even beyond just the mechanical power of having that money in her coffers in order to run with it. It is also has a demonstration effect to people that actually being involved in politics on an individual, on a small basis, is meaningful and can actually be an answer to this oligarchic form of power that is expressed at the highest level.
One of the saddest things I've experienced during my time as someone who pays attention to politics is watching people I know who don't have a tremendous amount of money, giving over that money to political campaigns because they believe that it's a way to achieve things that will help them in their lives. And it's really heartbreaking when those changes that we really do need don't come to fruition.
I also spoke with a major Democratic donor here on the East Coast who told me that he had also spoken personally with Harris since she had become the candidate and that he felt she was making outreach to the business community that Joe Biden had never tried to.
Yeah, I do think there is a difference between how Biden thinks about business and how Harris does. And she comes from California, meaning that when she was attorney general, she was called upon to make judgments about where she was going to position herself with regards to things like labor issues or market access. And ultimately, she was perceived as being more or less friendly to some of her big constituents in the state, Meta, Alphabet, these big tech companies. And that ultimately may be politically important because, as somebody very close to Biden once said to me, look, at the end of the day, he may be from Delaware, which is the corporate state, but he's never been comfortable around money. It's just not his natural habitat. He doesn't particularly understand it. He can't speak to it politically.
Okay, so Evan is sort of making my point for me here. Harris might be taking in lots more small dollar donations than Trump, but ultimately, she is quite cozy with these corporations and the Silicon Valley elite, way more so than Joe Biden, who Osnos here depicts as some kind of bumpkin who doesn't know which fork to use at the fancy dinners or whatever. Really quite comical that the senator from Delaware, which is like America's shell company in so many ways, who was and is the president. Isn't that funny, by the way, that Joe Biden right now is the president? Sometimes I forget that that's the case, but it's true. Anyway, whatever relationship he has with corporate America, Osnos is saying Harris knows them and likes them more and has made policy decisions in the past that they're happy with. Have I made my point? I think I have.
But on the other hand, it may really alienate some of the very progressive parts of the Democratic Party. They're going to be behind her for the election, I'm sure.
I wouldn't be so sure about that, but we'll find out soon enough.
We at The New Yorker had a wonderful piece recently about the Bitcoin lobby and how powerful it is and who's running it. A former Al Gore person, Chris Lehane, a big Democrat. The lines are not clear, really, 100% when it comes to super money, especially in Silicon Valley. And it's something to keep an eye on.
So just one more paragraph here from Susan Glasser's article about the sorts of things Jane was just talking about. In at least one notable case, Harris managed to regain a major donor who had defected to Trump, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist Ben Horowitz. Horowitz and his business partner, Mark Andreessen, who are both longtime Democratic givers, had stunned the tech world in July by endorsing the ex-president, citing, in part, Trump's newfound support for the crypto industry. But in October, Horowitz announced that he and his wife planned to make a significant donation to Harris, saying that though the Biden administration had been, quote, exceptionally destructive on tech policy, end quote, he had spoken personally with Harris, a friend from California, and was hopeful that she would take a different approach. According to Open Secrets, big donors, those who gave $100,000 or more to just one party, contributed $5.2 billion to Democratic causes and candidates in this last election cycle, and $3.3 billion to Republican ones. Despite Trump's cultivation of the crypto bros and Wall Street money, his online chats with Musk and his Mar-a-Lago fundraisers with big oil executives, that trend is on track to continue this year. A recent Bloomberg survey of billionaires showed Harris received support from 21 of the country's richest people, compared with 14 who were backing Trump. The difference, though, is that Trump had taken in millions more from these supporters. His campaign is far more dependent on its shrinking segment of the ultra-rich. Anyway, there you have it, folks. Billionaires like both of these guys, but a smaller group of billionaires is willing to give more to Trump. Though, on the whole, billionaires as a group seem to prefer Harris. So please take that into account when making your choice of who to vote for if you haven't already. As you know, there's very little time between now and the presidential election, but I do plan to do one more very special episode between now and November 5th, so look forward to that. A little hint here, it might involve a very famous American DJ who's going to be performing in New York City this weekend. That's all I'll say for now. Until next time, be well. My mom.